You know, when somebody hands you their very sick child, you are aware that this person is handing you their entire world. It's a scary thing, but it's just a tremendous honor to be trusted that way.
Hey, it's Julie. Welcome to Uncomfy. A lot of us are struggling right now with how to stay open to others. When we seem to be living in different realities, I feel like I'm always walking on eggshells with people. But I also don't want to give up on connecting with people. This podcast is about staying with the moments we usually want to escape, the awkward ones, the tense ones, the ones that honestly can probably teach us something. So let's get uncomfy.
As you're walking up, the house always appears quiet and still. And so you have no idea what's on the other side of that door. You know, your heart is pounding. You feel that adrenaline rush. Your whole body kind of shivers. And then, you know, you bang on the door and it opens and you step inside.
Friends, I want you to meet Kevin Hazard. He is a former paramedic. He's also an author, a journalist, a TV and film writer. His memoir is called 1,000 Naked Strangers. And he's got a brand new book. It's called No One's Coming, The Rogue Heroes Our Government Turns to When There's Nowhere Else to Turn. He has some uncomfy stories to tell. Kevin, thanks so much for your time today. Welcome.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about that particular response then, the call that you went out on that you were just thinking about as you were describing.
Yeah. So, you know, holidays always seem to bring two things. One is relative quiet, but also big chaotic calls. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, people are coming into town. And a lot of times when people travel, they don't necessarily bring all their medicines. They don't necessarily follow their routines. And so Thanksgiving and Christmas for me always brought these big medical emergencies. And we got called out to a woman who, in the middle of Thanksgiving dinner, went into cardiac arrest. Her entire family was there. Her heart stops beating. She stops breathing. She drops unconscious on the floor. Mm. You can imagine.
Woman, is this like the matriarch of the family?
It is, of course. You know, it wouldn't. Yeah. You know, it would never be any other way. You know, it would. It would have to be. You know, the person that everybody sort of turns to in times of crisis. And of course, the crisis in this situation is hers. So you know, you've got 8, 10, 12 people of various generations, grandchildren, children, her husband, sort of the full spectrum of a family. And she's at the head of the table. She sort of leaned forward, gasped, pounded the table one time, and it just slipped from her chair underneath the table. They grabbed it, they yanked it. And then from there, they realize what's happening and just panic breaks out among all these family members.
How far were you into your career when this particular Thanksgiving call happened?
This was my first cardiac arrest, so I was brand new. My partner had been around for a while, but I was new. And I remember driving over and, you know, a call will come out and they'll say, you know, a cardiac arrest, whatever. And you don't necessarily know. But then the dispatcher came back on while we were driving and she said CPR in progress. So now we know this is real. And I can remember, you know, when adrenaline sort of shoots through your body, what it leaves in its wake is this sort of cold shiver. And I had this slight tremble, not like a fear tremble, but just, I felt cold. I felt really cold. Even though it was a warm day, it was the middle of the afternoon, I felt cold.
This is Atlanta, right?
Yeah, it was Atlanta. Yeah. You know, November in Atlanta is not a particularly cold time. And I just felt it. My partner, I'm sure, knew that. You know, he knew my heart rate was going up. He knew how I was reacting because at one point he had been in that situation. And he just turned to me and he said, man, I've done a lot of these. We're going to be all right. But that's only just so much comfort when you know that he's going to be relying on you. You know, it's just the two of you. You and your partner really need to be in sync. And I didn't want to be the reason that something went wrong.
Gosh, I almost hate to ask how it turned out because my heart is racing right now just even thinking about the stress of that, walking in with so much on your shoulders and feeling like, are we up to this? How did it go?
It went the way most of them go, quite frankly. It's very, very difficult to bring somebody back from the brink. You know, oftentimes our job is not so much to save as it is to sort of prepare everybody for what's going to come next. So here, this is a perfect example of this. We run this call. We do not get her back. We get to the hospital. A family member rode with us. We get there. By the time we have handed the patient over to the doctors and they've continued their efforts. And finally, it's called and we stop. I walked outside and the family had by then arrived. Now, I've never done one of these before. I know only that the last time they saw me, we were making attempts to save their mother, their grandmother, their sister, their wife. And now she's gone. And they know it. And so I walk outside and I'm not sure how they're going to respond to me. And one by one, they came up and they all just hugged me. And it obviously wasn't because that we had saved this woman, but that they saw what we did. They saw how well it went. They saw that work that we put into it, how hard we tried. And they felt comforted by how much work that we had put into saving this woman who we didn't know, who didn't mean anything to us, but who to them meant everything. And that was a remarkable moment.
I guess that's the double side of the work that you do as paramedics and first responders that I hadn't really thought of before, which is that everything you do is on full display. Everyone's watching you. The family is crowded around you as you're doing this, or, you know, you're like trying to, it's just the two of you trying to focus on the life that you're trying to save, but also all this other stuff going on. I would have thought that would be like the biggest downside of this job, as opposed to, you know, my father died and the cardiac arrest happened back in a room when he was hospitalized, and we didn't see the work that went on. And part of me thought, well, that was probably a good thing. But also there's always this little doubt, right? Like, well, gosh, did they respond fast enough? Were they ignoring him? Like, was there, you know, so to hear that it was on full display, that you're under scrutiny, and that on some level that is, I guess, a benefit.
It's good and bad. It can be tricky because there is no buffer between you and people who are going through a terrible thing.
Yeah.
So you have very little protection from people who I think sometimes act out, not necessarily out of malice, but just out of the emotion of the moment. That's not necessarily unexpected. But yeah, you're there, you know, you're with them. You're in this person's space. You know, you are surrounded by all of what her life was, not only the people, but the things. You're in her home, you're on her floor, she's still in her clothes, there's her bedroom, there are photographs on the wall. It's really, really, it's an incredibly personal form of medicine.
Did you enjoy it? This was one of your earlier calls. You stayed in it for at least a decade, right? Like,
yeah.
I guess you enjoyed it? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, first off, I was in my 20s and early 30s. It is, in my opinion, some people stick it out for a very long time, but it is, in my opinion, it's a young person's game because it is a very physical thing. You're upstairs, you're downstairs, you're out in the highway, you're on street corners, you're in all kinds of difficult places. You do have no help, so everything needs to be done by you. You are both sort of providing life-saving care and security all at once. I mean, it's a whole thing. But when I talk to other people who did this and who are no longer in it, and one of us says, you know, do you miss it? The thing that either one of us will always say is, what I miss is a warm Friday afternoon. You can be working a night shift with one of your favorite partners, and there's just sort of an electric feeling in the air, and you know the city is alive and things are going to happen and you're going to be called to do it, and it's going to be crazy and chaotic, but also fun and challenging. And there's a feeling to that you will not find anywhere else. It is such a specific thing. And, you know, you take two paramedics, I mean, they walk through the door with nothing but, you know, in many cases, their sense of humor, a wristwatch, and a pen. You know what I mean? We don't have any protection. There is no, you know, there's no bulletproof vest. There is no sense that, you know, we are in control. There's no command. We simply have to make a connection with somebody who's having a difficult moment, and we have to make it on their terms. And we need to figure out, you know, how we can navigate what is oftentimes a very dangerous moment. And that is, there is a lot of fun to be had in that, for sure. But it's a very weird world it's a weird way to learn about the world, you know, as a young person delivering babies in people's homes, or being on the highway as cars are rocketing past you, abandoned buildings, high rises. It's a very strange view of the world.
You write that you started as a tourist and then you became a true believer. What's the difference there? Explain that for me.
I think I entered into it with many of the expectations that a lot of people do. I had seen an emergency crew at work, and I remember being taken with the way that they carried themselves. They seemed to know something about life, about death, about the world. They had this knowledge that they had earned somehow that most of us weren't going to be able to touch. And I wanted that. I wanted to feel that way. I wanted to walk that way. I wanted people to look at me and think, that guy's been there. But I presumed that, well, I'll just get this job and it will sort of confer that upon me. But of course, it's never the case. And, you know, you actually have to walk it. And, you know, initially, yeah, I was sort of going through the motions, but I was there for the experience. And what life teaches all of us, of course, as we age is that, you know, it is the living and in the connecting and the doing and the failing and the trying and getting back up that brings the experience. It isn't simply, you know, showing up, clocking in, walking through the door and, you know, having those really personal moments with people, not always very sick people. Sometimes, you know, there's an 87-year-old woman whose husband is dead and whose children live two states away and she's lonely. And so she calls because she wants someone to sit in the side of the bed and talk to her for 30 minutes. That's a profound thing when you're 26 years old and you realize, you know, how this process works and how life works. And those are the sort of things, much more so than the sirens and the blood and all the crazy scenes, which are, look, it is fun to be standing in the midst of this huge crime scene and helicopters overhead and just people everywhere and police and the news cameras and all, like, there's something to that. But those quiet moments when it's just you and another person who looks to you for help, those were the things that really drew me in and made me a genuine believer in practicing medicine this way.
Did it change how you interacted with other people in your life? Not to be too dramatic about it, but did it like change you, the way you show up in the world?
It can't not. You know, at some point you will be called out to someone who has just died, someone who was not expected to die, car accident, what have you. And you'd be standing over this person and, you know, you'll sort of pull their wallet out of their back pocket so you can know who they are. Who is this human being? And it never would fail. I would look at them and think, you know, okay, Joe, your family doesn't know, but I know. Like, you got dressed this morning. You put on your belt. You got in your car. You had somewhere to go. And now here we are. And I'm the only one who knows, but it's over. And it was not supposed to be over today. And you can only see that so many times before you think, you know, mine is out there somewhere. You know, we all have an endpoint and it's not going to come in all likelihood when you expect it to. Perhaps I should take advantage of these moments, you know, and be more present and, you know, take advantage now of the people around you.
How were you able to stay open to the human connection during this career, rather than just come to start seeing everyone as a body, you know, oh, here's another meat sack that I need to, you know, work on, right?
Yeah, by failing to do so, usually. You know, everybody, when I was brand new, I was told, look, everybody burns out. It is not whether or not you'll burn out. It's when you'll burn out and then how you'll respond to it. Some people burn out and they just get bitter and they become bad providers, maybe bad people, I don't know. But I certainly did. And what, you know, what sort of brings you back is how you respond to that. So a perfect example, sort of one of the big moments for me. And again, understand how young I am. I'm in my early 20s. I'm so inexperienced. But we had a guy called all the time and he was just rude. He was homeless and he was just angry, you know, and he was just bitter. And he would just sort of yell at you and call you every name in the book, which is something you're used to. You know, you roll with it. It's like part of the job. So he started chewing me out. For whatever reason that day, it sort of pierced me and it got to my real self, not my work self. And I snapped back at him. And for just a second, we almost started to argue. And then it something clicked in my head. And I thought, what are you doing? Like, you're sitting here, like, arguing with this man who clearly has issues. Just, like, shut up. And so I said to him, I said, look, you call all the time. We don't call you. You call us. And every time we get here, you're awful. You yell at us. You call, like, why? What? Why? And he turns to me, and this is, you know, a man in his 40s. And he says, I have AIDS. And my family and my friends have all walked away from me because of that. So not only am I going to die, that I'm going to die alone. And I'm scared and I'm angry. I was not prepared for that moment. At 26, 27, I had not lived enough. I had not, you know, I was not self-aware enough to be ready for him to say that to me. And it was like a slap in the face. It hit me hard. And, you know, obviously what I said to him sort of got through in some sort of way because he was real and honest with me. But it was clearly a much bigger moment for me than it was for him. And that was, you know, a wake up that everyone you see is a real person. And, you know, there's that cliche, you know, be nice. You don't know what somebody else is dealing with. Easy words to say. But when you're faced with it in such stark terms, like I was in that moment, it kind of sinks in. It you know, it solidifies. And certainly, and, you know, that was one of those moments for me where, you know, I had to stop and say, okay, this is just a person, no different from me, who's going through something really hard. And imagine being in his shoes. Imagine how you would feel. Probably I'd be the same way. I'd probably be bitter and angry too.
You know, we're accustomed to thinking of first responders as heroes. And, you know, we use that word a lot even with them. How would you describe what that work is? And what do you wish those of us who are most likely to be on the receiving end understood?
I wouldn't have said this at the time, but it is heroic work, just not in the way that people think. It's incredibly compassionate. You know, here's the easiest way I can describe it. There's this move in medicine to refer to patients as clients. And I think it's, you know, this, we kind of live in a society where everything is monetized and, you know, modern managements really want you to look at a patient as a customer because they want you to see the dollar bills that are going to keep the system afloat. But I always said, I would not let a customer throw up on me. I would not let a customer bleed on me. I would not let a customer punch me. I would not crawl through, you know, ooze to save a customer. But I would do all those things. And I have done those things for patients. There's a real personal, tangible connection between patient and provider. And that connection is compassion. It is empathy. It is understanding. And when I say understanding, an understanding from the patient that you are here for me, and an understanding from the provider that I am here for you and I'm going to do whatever you need in this moment, regardless of what my personal feelings of you or it may be. You know, everybody has something that grosses them out. At some point, you're going to have to deal with the thing that grosses you out. So, you know, just get in there and touch it. This person has trusted you. You know, when somebody hands you their child, their sick, very sick child, you are aware on some level that this person is handing you their entire world. It's a scary thing, but it's just a tremendous honor to be trusted that way. And so to me, that's what the essence of this job is. It's trust in an incredibly vulnerable moment. You know, trust that I won't judge you, trust that I'll be there for you, trust that I'm good enough, you know, as advertised to do the job, but mainly, you know, that trust that I'm going to care enough to really do all the things that need to be done in this moment. And so there is something heroic about that, but not in the TV or movie way, but just like in a really human way.
Before I let you go, let me have you just tell us just a few things about this new book that you've got.
Yeah. So in July of 2014, a guy by the name of Dent Thompson was on vacation, and he gets a phone call from the U.S. State Department. And they said, Americans are dying of Ebola in West Africa. Not exactly sure how many of them, not exactly sure where they are, but nobody else on earth is willing or able to get them home. Will you help? And so the book is about the 10 days that follow that phone call. You know, who the heck is Dent Thompson that he gets that phone call? Who are these people? Why are they there? And how is this rescue going to take place? And it's about the doctors, the nurses, the pilots, the engineers on both sides of the Atlantic, people working in Africa and people working here in the States that were risking their lives to save Ebola patients in the midst of what became the deadliest Ebola outbreak in human history. And it's an incredible story of people doing heroic things for strangers simply because it's the right thing to do.
It's called No One's Coming, the rogue heroes our government turns to when there is nowhere else to turn. Kevin Hazard is an author, journalist, TV and film writer, and a former paramedic. Kevin, thanks so much. I'm really looking forward to the new book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you for getting uncomfy with us today. Have you ever had to call emergency services? Or have you ever thought about what that might be like for the person who's responding, who we're relying on to save the day? When he was talking about how fundamentally it's a career of compassion and human connection, that really resonated with me. I thought about all of the caregivers and parents and anyone who really works in that vulnerable space, that boundary where people are at their most needy and exposed, and we are making our deepest connections as human beings. I appreciated what he shared. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email uncomfy@byu.edu or connect with us on social media. We are at uncomfy.podcast on Instagram. I'd love to hear your story. And let me know what other kinds of uncomfy stories you'd like to hear on the show. Uncomfy is a BYU radio podcast. Samuel Benson produces it. And the team includes Hyobin Kim and Abby Karras. Our theme music was composed by Kelsey Ney. I'm Julie Rose. Can't wait to get uncomfy with you again next week. Before I leave you, I want to recommend another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts that I'm pretty sure you're going to love. It's called Constant Wonder, and it consistently, or should I say constantly, ranks near the top of Apple's nature podcasts in their rankings. But Constant Wonder is about more than just nature. It's about finding awe in everything around us, including our own backyards. So on the show, you'll hear guests share stories of spiritual encounters with nature, of real life accounts of human kindness and bravery, like a doctor on a quest to bring care to the homeless. See the world with new eyes as host Marcus Smith invites us to find wonder in every corner of life. Listen to new episodes of Constant Wonder every Wednesday on the BYU Radio app or wherever you listen to podcasts.